Playwright Chinaka Hodge writes, sings, studies, and directs plays about Oakland. She went to school in New York and Southern California, but her artistic work has always focused on her hometown, most recently on the gentrification she sees happening in Oakland, while native Oaklanders, she says, continue to live in poverty.
This is the sound. West Oakland becomes auction block for Bam Bam sold. But Bam Bam sold, sold, sold. A fine young negress with much potential. Her lover just died, so she should be supple. But Bam Bam sold, 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 sold. It's 3:30, 18th and Myrtle, and it's time to care.
Hodge's latest play is called Chasing Messerly, in reference to Johannes Messerly, the BART police officer who killed Hayward teen Oscar Grant at the Fruitvale BART station in 2009. In her play, a fictional character, Watts, has been agoraphobic since seeing the Rodney King beatings as a child. He makes a New Year's resolution to finally leave the house on January 1st, 2009, the same day Grant is murdered by Messerly. Chinaka Hodge came by our studios to talk about the play and a changing Oakland.
If I traveled around the country and said I was from Oakland, people would sort of lean back a little bit and screw their faces and say, oh, I'm so sorry. I hear that it's a really violent place. Or that's where MC Hammer's from. Or Ebonics debate. Or, you know, if I'm lucky, MC Hammer and En Vogue. I'm like, yes, yes, yes. And all those things are true. And then you fast forward 15 years and the coverage is kind of like Oakland's a cool swank place to be all of a sudden, or it's the butt of jokes on shows like Up All Night, or a punchline in, on a show like Parks and Rec. When I say I'm from Oakland and Hollywood, it's kind of like saying that I'm from Brooklyn in a way that Brooklyn was hot 8 years ago. I don't quite know how to explain it. We went from being like, kind of, you know, like Biggie would say, trashy to classy. And it happened based on the way that the media is covering it. Oakland has shifted a lot, but the core of Oakland has not changed. Mm. And I'm interested in telling the story about the people who are from there, the people who have lived there, the people who have sort of been through the rites, rituals, and practices that make you a true Oaklander, as opposed to the way it's being covered by a bunch of new folks who've moved in, as well as folks who are sort of looking at it from afar and see new restaurants and shinier streets and new street signs. And while development, I think, can be helpful to a city like Oakland, I think development that's inclusive of so much displacement is really an act of violence. And so I'm interested in writing about those acts of violence, as well as the real Oakland, where I'm from, what I love, where, you know, where I grew up, where I skinned my knee, where I fell in love, where I had my crushes, you know.
In Oakland, the city of my birth, we don't say done. We don't say God. We don't say ma. We don't say earth. I called you cousin. Since 3 and 4, we've been tandem redbone. You guitar to my milkman. You Sealy to my Nettie. 8 and 9 when we burned our knee on the iron. 11 and 12 when we got our first boyfriends. 17 when you told me you'd left those alone. Cool.
Then suddenly there are so many discussions about a changing Oakland, as you mentioned. San Francisco residents spilling into Oakland with sky-high rents in San Francisco, the G-word, gentrification. Mm-hmm. Has your relationship with the town changed as it changes?
I think that my relationship with the town has changed as I change. My feeling for the town has changed as well. It's disorienting to come home. I travel a lot, so I come home, and every time I come home, downtown Oakland is slightly different. It's alienating in a way to me and some of the other friends I've talked to who are from there. We don't feel like we belong in many ways in the city that we've always, it's been the only place we could go, our safe haven. Plenty of kids I knew from Oakland who were growing up there never went to San Francisco. We never partied on that side of the bridge, on this side of the bridge. We had just what we had, and we made it work. And we had, you know, a nightlife, a thriving scene. It wasn't as robust as it is now, but it was ours. And I feel in many ways that home is not as home as it once was. And I don't think that what we've done has changed. It's just a new layer, a new blanket of folks who have come in, and new bars and new social scenes and the art murmurs. And
what do you think that does to a town?
I think it adds value. And I think that even adding value is something that, you know, is a double-edged sword. It adds value, so, you know, property is harder to come by and harder for, you know, people who have been renting or wanted to own their homes and have been saving towards that for a long time. And then, you know, market rates skyrocket and all of a sudden we can't afford our homes. We can't afford gas. We can't afford, you know, the staples in a city that's always been a chocolate city, that's always been a landing point for first and second generation Asian American families. It's always been a place where Latino folks could, you know, could find work and shelter. And I was looking at, I'm writing an article that'll run in the San Francisco Magazine June issue, which is an Oakland issue. And just found some really interesting statistics about, you know, Oakland was at one point 43% black, and now it's at 26%. And that's over the last decade. So you're talking about basically a 20-point differential between the black folks that were there. It was a half black town, and now it's, you know, about a quarter black. And those figures are sort of true, you know, along the spectrum. So it's hard to watch my city be called better because it's getting, to be honest, whiter. And not see the racial implications of that, the institutionalized racism. I don't think any one person who moves in is a racist because they move in. But I think a system of saying, okay, we think your place is cool now and now we want it, a manifest destiny approach to the last city and the, you know, on the edge of the country, it's sort of like, I feel in many ways like the last of the Mohicans. Like, you can't take it. You can't take it without a fight. And I'm not going to fight you in the streets, but I will fight you on a page.
Let's talk about the hipsters.
Let's talk about them.
There is a fun video,
mm-hmm.
a little disturbing,
mm-hmm.
that you were featured in, mm-hmm. music video. Here it is.
Rinse up, that no good. Starbucks where the skate rink stood. It's a fixture, it does no good.
That's Kill a Hipster by George Watsky, featuring my guest Chinaka Hodge. So, Chinaka, what's a hipster to you?
Someone who is a gentrifier and knows it or doesn't know. Someone who thinks art and culture are tantamount to any other political or paramount to any other political activity. Someone who is blithely unaware of their own existence and the ways in which the things that they find cool or attractive or trendy or sort of subversive can also be offensive or violent or painful for the people who have been there. So in the video, you can't see it on the radio, obviously, but in the video, we kill the zombies who are approaching and taking over our barbecue in a park with implements of art. So we kill them with records, with my brother, who's a professional drummer's drumsticks, and with pencils and pens, which are George and I's our weapon of choice. So as violent as this thing is, we're killing the undead with things you can't kill people with, but actually educate them with. And so that's sort of what we're aiming at in the video. We're talking about using art as a medium of discussing major social issues. If I can make a piece of art that gets over 400,000 views on YouTube, that creates conversation all over the world, all over the country, talking about issues that are salient to me and my neighborhood, and then in forums that I and at levels I can't reach otherwise, take it, bless it, kiss it up to God. That's what it is.
So from that to Chasing Meserly.
Mm-hmm.
So what inspired this other than the obvious, the killing of Oscar Grant? Why did you feel you needed to make this?
So Chasing Meserly is a piece. It's a sequel to another play I've written called Mirrors in Every Corner. Mirrors follows a black family living in the Bay Area between 1988 and what was at the time the play went up for the first time, the present. So between 1988 and 2008. And it follows a black family that's dealing with major issues in race, class, gender, and privilege. Watts is one of the characters in the play, and in the first play and in the second play. And Watts sees the Rodney King beatings and riots on television as a small child and thinks, if that's what life is like for black men on the outside, I'm just never going to go out into the world. I'm never going to do it. So he makes a New Year's resolution to go out into the world 20 years later. But that New Year's happens to be January 1st, 2009, the day that Oscar Grant is tragically killed by Officer Johannes Messerly at Fruitvale BART station. So that's a launching point for the play. It's really, I have to say this emphatically, the play is not about Oscar Grant's life. My play is a fictional character moving through a fictionalized Oakland for the next year and a half, 2 years. So there's something emblematic of systemic decay and systemic devaluation of black life in this country. They're trying to kill black boys. And when I say they, I mean a wide variety of people, including black boys, are trying to kill other black boys. And so this play is aiming at talking about it in an honest way, sort of exercising those demons, allowing actors to speak about their anger in a way that you can't in a Hollywood movie, to talk about grief in a way that we can't in mixed company.
Here's a clip where Watts' mother has just witnessed the killing of Oscar Grant and thinks about what she'll say to her son.
They will kill you. They will undo all of my work in seconds while everyone watches. They will make you a holiday before you can argue or protest or run.
Chasing Messerly, it's a ritual. It's a rite that allows us to cry, you know, that allows us to really hold space for the demons to make their way out of our bodies.